second day. We had a very interesting day yesterday. Today, it's going to be really interesting as well. This session is called National R&D and Promotional Strategies for Artificial Intelligence Approaches and Lessons to Date. And of course, to moderate that, Dominic Gillec, Head of Division for Science and Technology Policy at OECD. Welcome.
Thank you, Martin. So as you said yesterday, we had a long day. I hope you all recovered from the dinner. That will be an intensive first session that we'll start with. Yesterday we heard a lot on the potential of these new technologies, how transformative they will be for science, for innovation, and of course, more broadly, for society. We also heard that many of these transformations are, the present stage, more promises than realities. They are in sort of infancy, but and the future is bright, but it is the future. So in this context, in view of their importance, many countries, I should say probably all countries, all governments are contemplating putting together and implementing national strategies for promoting AI mainly, but usually blockchain and high performance computing are not far. You certainly know of these words by President Putin saying that more or less the country that will dominate AI will dominate the world. Not necessarily the future that we want, but it tells us something about the importance of these technologies and why all countries, all governments are watching them very, very carefully. So yesterday we heard more of the technological aspects and really looking into the science machinery. My notion is that today we will look more at the economic and the policy dimensions. So that will be the series of three sessions for today. And to start with, so we'll be looking at the national strategies. For discussing that, we have five distinguished speakers coming from five different countries or areas which are all active in the field. And we'll start with Elisa Strom. Elisa is Executive Director of the Pan-Canadian AI Strategy at CIFAR. So you have 12 minutes. Right. And after 10 minutes, I will make a signal.
Perfect. Good morning, everyone. It really is a privilege and an honor to be here today. I was telling some people yesterday, this week in Canada is our National Science Policy Conference. So all of the science policy people get together in Ottawa every November to talk about, you know, the same old issues with the same old people. And I had a choice to be there or to be here, and I clearly made the right choice. So it's been a it's been a wonderful day yesterday. I learned so much from all of you, and I'm really feel very honored to be able to share with you what we've learned in Canada over the last 18 months or so since we launched our own AI R&D strategy. So Canada's leadership in AI goes back about 30 years, actually. The organization that I work for, CIFAR, actually was founded in 1982, and the very first research program that we launched in 83 was called Artificial Intelligence, Robotics, and Society. CIFAR's mandate is to support researchers coming together around the world to address important topics facing society, and we've been doing that for 35 years across every sector in a multidisciplinary international fashion. AI was our first example and our first experiment in doing this. But over the years in Canada, we've built up really three major research clusters in AI research, and they've been led primarily by these three individuals here. Top left is Professor Yoshua Bengio, who's located at the University of Montreal. In the middle, it's a bit of a dark picture, but it's Geoffrey Hinton, who is sort of widely recognized as the founding father of deep learning. And on the far right is Professor Rich Sutton, who is at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, and he's a pioneering leader in reinforcement learning. So in Montreal, Toronto, and Edmonton primarily, we have been building up great research clusters and expertise around these three individuals who have been training graduate students, attracting great colleagues from around the world to join them in this endeavor. What really sort of catalyzed much of the work in AI in Canada was a CIFAR program that was launched in 2004, led by Jeff Hinton, but including all of the individuals seen here, called Learning in Machines and Brains. It's still an active program today, includes many researchers around the world, not just Canadians. And it was through Learning in Machines and Brains that Jeff had the idea to bring what we know about neuroscience, what we know about how the human brain works, and apply that to machine learning and the eventual advent of machine learning. And that program is actually really widely credited with the development of many of the deep learning applications that we all know and love in our pocket devices today. So it's been quite a history of leadership in AI research and development in Canada. And because of that history and because of CIFAR's role in particular, the government asked us to lead our national R&D strategy last year when they launched it. So Canada was the first country in the world to launch an AI strategy. I want to be very clear that it is specifically focused on academic research and development. There are four key pillars to the strategy, and the first was to establish three major centers of excellence, independent research institutes in our three major hubs. And so we launched AIMI in Edmonton, that's the Alberta Machine Intelligence Institute, MILA in Montreal, and the Vector Institute in Toronto. And so these were created brand new in 2017, really sort of gathering much of the existing expertise and leadership and research capacity within their three centers and really sort of co-locating them and collecting them within a major hub of activity. The second pillar of the strategy is the Canada CIFAR AI Chairs Program, and this program is really about talent. So the goal of the program is to attract and retain about 50 research leaders in AI in Canada. It's a program that will name them as Canada CIFAR AI Research Chairs, and will fund their research, give them a salary top-up, and fund their graduate students. So it's a funding program to keep many of the great researchers that we have in Canada where they are, but also the goal is in fact to attract half of the people that will be named through this program will be new recruits to Canada. So talent is a key aspect of our strategy. We're also working on supporting research activities across the country. So I help to organize or sponsor research workshops, training programs, events, conferences, activities, really across the country to support and foster collaboration between researchers, not just across the country, but across domains of science as well, too. And the last part of our strategy, which is a really critical and essential part, I think, of an AI strategy, is our AI in Society program. This is a program that's led through CIFAR as really an international research program on the societal implications of AI. And so I'll tell you a little bit more about all of these aspects of the strategy, starting with the AI institutes. So what's been fascinating is that they've all really sort of leveraged and built on their history, leveraged their ecosystem, and built AI research institutes that have really distinct flavors. So in Edmonton, as I've mentioned, they have a particular expertise in reinforcement learning. And so they've capitalized that on that and brought in great experts in reinforcement learning, but also in the applications of reinforcement learning. It's a partnership with the University of Alberta as the primary university that's involved, but also funded by the provincial government through their innovation agencies. With respect to how each of the institutes is collaborating with industry, again, they've all approached it in a different way. And so that is a really sort of unique and interesting aspect of the strategy as well. Many of you will be familiar with the company DeepMind, a really renowned AI research company. The very first research lab that DeepMind set up outside of the UK is actually in Edmonton. Edmonton is a small northern Alberta city. It's not known for anything except for reinforcement learning. So it was really quite a surprise when DeepMind made this investment. But they have long-standing partnerships and collaborations with the key pioneering leaders in reinforcement learning. And so that led to their establishing a lab there. In Montreal, It's a much larger research cluster focused on many different aspects of machine learning, deep learning, reinforcement learning, lots of natural language processing happening there, lots of focus on health applications in AI, lots of focus on the societal implications of AI, and AI for good is a major theme in Montreal. It's a partnership between both the University of Montreal, which is the French language university in the city, and McGill University, which is the English language university. So researchers from both places are part of this research institute. And it's been significantly invested in by the province of Quebec. So the province of Quebec invested an additional $100 million into AI research and building up an AI research ecosystem in Quebec. As far as industry collaborations go, what we've seen actually in Montreal, because they have a very, very deep talent pool, they've been training graduate students for decades and lots of expertise, is that the technology companies have set up their AI R&D labs in Montreal. And so over the last few months, last year or so, we've seen companies like Facebook setting up an AI research lab in Montreal, Microsoft, Google, DeepMind, and many others, in fact. And really interestingly, the professors in the universities have cross appointments in industry. And so they're spending, you know, somewhere between 20, 30, sometimes 50% of their time in the industry AI labs. And that's giving them the best of both worlds, in fact. They see it as an opportunity to continue with their academic research and their teaching and their graduate supervision, but also having access to the expertise and the resources and the data that's available in the industry lab. So it's a different approach, and it's a very healthy ecosystem, and I think it's been successful so far because it's a very tight-knit ecosystem. The researchers have all been working together for a long time. Many of them are part of our CIFAR program, and they feel sort of deep ties to their academic institution, but also interested in advancing the applications as well. Toronto is my hometown. It is absolutely exploding in AI right now. So I think a report came out in July this year that showed that Toronto created more tech jobs than any other city in North America in the previous 12 months. So it was 30,000 tech jobs created in Toronto. It is absolutely exploding. The Vector Institute is really focused on machine learning. They have been very clear that that's their focus, that's their mandate. And they took a different approach to partnering with industry. From the very beginning, they said, if we're going to build this research institute that is training the next generation of talent, that is advancing the science, we want industry to be there with us side by side from the very beginning. And so they, in fact, brought in their industry partners as founding sponsors of the institute. And so they've created then a whole series of programs for engaging and working with and collaborating with their industry sponsors. So it's a very, very close relationship. And they have 40 industry sponsors for this particular institute, including all five of our national banks, which is unique to see all five of our banks collaborating in one space. But lots of multinationals, of course, involved in the Vector Institute, the tech companies that you're familiar with. Uber has a very large autonomous vehicles research lab in Toronto that's just down the hall, in fact, from the Vector Institute. And it's a very, very active environment. So that's the overview of our three institutes. But, of course, we have great research hubs and expertise in cities across the country. So Vancouver is a very active and vibrant AI ecosystem. There's two universities there, UBC and Simon Fraser University. And the proximity to Seattle and to Silicon Valley, in fact, really helps to support that work. And the other city that I should mention is Waterloo. So University of Waterloo is well recognized for its engineering program, and they have a lot of AI research expertise there as well. I'll skip over a little bit the national program activities, but the key point that I want to leave you with here is that we have had a particular focus, especially this year, on developing programs that engage women in AI, and particularly young women. So we have programs for high school students to expose young women in high school to AI. We have a program, the AI for Social Good Lab, which is for undergraduate students, undergraduate women, and getting them engaged in AI. So that's a particular area of focus in Canada and part of our strategy. And I mentioned the AI and Society program. We have certainly a domestic program for those of you who are in policy. One of our programs is called the AI and Society Policy Labs, where we actually go across the country to centers of provincial governments and run workshops for early stage career policymakers and giving them exposure and advice and guidance on what are the societal implications of AI. A big part of our activity in AI and Society, though, is on the international stage and working with partners around the world. And CIFAR is advising the Canadian government on its role in leading the discussion on AI and Society. So this year, Canada was the host of the G7 meetings, and AI was a major topic of discussion there. Canada has a significant partnership with France, in fact, on understanding the societal implications of AI. And we're working very closely as well with the UK. So lots of opportunities for facilitating conversation, bringing people together, and sort of sharing ideas and best practices around AI in society. So how do we know it's working? So it's been a short period of time, and it's been a whirlwind, but my biggest and best point of evidence that we know it's working is all of the amazing researchers that we have either recruited brand new to Canada or have kept in Canada. And these are just some of the faces behind the research that's happening at our three AI institutes. This year, in December, on December 3rd in Montreal, we are hosting the very first annual meeting of the Pan-Canadian AI Strategy, and it's a chance to bring researchers from across the country together. And at that meeting, we will name the first cohort of Canada CIFAR AI chairs. Originally, we thought over 5 years there would be 50 of these people. I expect to be naming 40 research chairs in Montreal on December 3rd. So we're really, really excited about that, and stay tuned for more news about that to come. And the last point of evidence that I'll share to indicate that it's working is really the fact that so many multinationals have set up brand new AI R&D labs in our various cities. And they're coming to partner with the researchers, they're coming to capitalize on the talent, they're coming to be part of our various AI ecosystems, and it's a very collaborative and healthy relationship right now. I'm going to skip over this one in the interest of time, but suffice it to say that the AI strategy is really one component in Canada's innovation policy sort of suite of programs. We have lots of programs lately and a very intense focus on supporting fundamental research. But in addition, just last year, the government launched a $950 million innovation supercluster initiative. So we're trying to make sure that our science and technology innovation policy covers not just the basic science, but also the role of industry and the applications of industry moving forward. So thank you all, and I'll be happy to share more through coffee and the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Elisa. Actually, OECD has been working quite closely with the Canadian government and now with the French government in the context of the G7, and will be in Montreal on December the 3rd. So we'll keep questions and interventions for the roundtable that will follow the five interventions. So please remember well what you wanted to ask Elisa about. Our next speaker is Shui Lan, who is professor at Tsinghua University and who is dean of the School for Public Policy and dean of another school as well, a multi-dean person. So the floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, I'm really honored to be here to share with you about the China's national R&D strategy for AI. I'll probably focus on three things. First of all, I think the national R&D strategy on AI development, and also the status of AI development in China, which is based on a report that we just completed a couple of months ago. And third, I'll just make some comment on the strengths and weaknesses of China's AI development. But of course, you have to keep this secret because I think this is my own assessment of this, and I'm currently, also a member of the Strategic Advisory Committee of the AI Development. So I don't want to get my boss angry about my comments. Anyway, so the China's National R&D Strategy for AI Development, and there are three kind of sort of elements. I think the first is the major policy document and policy support. I think China is sort of known, you know, for coming up with all kinds of plans and so on. You know, sometimes can be people are concerned about. Anyway, I think that first, I think that most recently, I think the the end of October, that President Xi Jinping spoke at the so-called ninth study session of Politburo. Chinese leadership has this called study sessions. I see, so about every month you have the top leaders would gather together and, you know, some experts would come and to speak about some current issue. And the most recent one was about AI. And so President Xi, you know, gave some comments of supporting the AI development and so on. The second key element is the so-called the July the 2017, after we learned that about Canada has an AI strategy and so China followed suit. And so there's the major, so the, you know, so-called the new generation AI development plan, and so that's a major one. And also, of course, previously there are some other elements in various kind of plans. The second is major, so the national R&D programs supporting AI research. And so the, you know, China has some major research for supporting, you know, various kind of research, and the AI has been a key element. One example is that in one of the focused R&D programs, and there is so-called intelligent manufacturing research that's focused on that, that, you know, started several years ago. And the third, I think China has been very much focused on the how to diffuse the technology and also in terms of the industrial development. So in December 2017, the Ministry of Information and Industry has a three-year action plan for AI industrialization. And also, I think in 2016, there's an interagency action plan for Internet Plus. And out of the 11 areas, AI is one of them. Now, let me just focus a bit about the AI plan that was released in 2017. I think a lot of focus on this. I think in this plan, there's, you know, so the strategic goals are set in by 2030, and China wants to, you know, to reach world advanced level in AI development and application and to become a major AI innovation center in the world. And the second part is more on the industry. China wants to develop sort of competitive AI industry and also to really make the AI application to be both in terms of production, daily life, governance, and the national defense. And also, I think the core, you know, there were some, you know, hopes that the core of AI industry was surpass 1 trillion RMB, and the related industry was surpass 10 trillion RMB. Again, this, you know, some aspirational goals. And the third is to also to have established a set of leading R&D, global R&D and education centers for AI, and also to have a refined AI legal frameworks, policy systems, and also ethical guidelines. So those are three sort of broader sets of goals. Some of the key tasks that, you know, basically was, first of all, I think to establish an open and coordinated AI STI system, and also to foster the development of high-end and high-efficient intelligent economy. And the third is establish secure and convenient intelligent society, and also to promote the civilian and military integration in AI development. And finally, is construct secure and highly efficient intelligence infrastructure. So those are sort of major, you know, key tasks. And also there's a whole set of supporting measures, how you do that. And one is to establish a legal framework and ethical guidelines for AI development, and also improving key policies to support AI development, and also to establish technology standards and IPR system for AI, and also establish AI safety regulation and assessment system, and also strengthening labor training, and also communication with the general public. So those are some of the key sort of broader policy support for AI development. Let me also just quickly mention about the China's position on policy on lethal autonomous weapon system, so-called laws. I think that since Charles mentioned about this yesterday, so I double-checked. First of all, I think China's position, actually, China was the first P5, first of the P5 member countries to call for a legally binding protocol on laws. China was citing the 1995 CCW protocol that banned blinding lasers, China basically saying that on AI, this should be followed. Unfortunately, no country in the P5 followed China's call. So in the most recent months, in April 2018, China sort of in a way backed off a little bit. China announced its support of a new protocol for the convention on certain conventional weapons to ban the use of the fully autonomous lethal weapon systems. So which actually, so I think the first in a position China was to ban everything. And now this is the ban of the use of lethal weapons. And you know, now there are about 28 countries on this. And in fact, US, Russia, Israel, France, and the United Kingdom explicitly rejected the proposal for such a ban. So this is just opposite to what Charles mentioned about yesterday. And I, of course, I checked Charles and we talked about Charles, you know, source was from a populist book. So which actually, is, you know, you see that all of the time. I mean, China was always blamed as a scapegoat for all these bad things. But actually, this is a real position on China on this. So I just want to make that clear. Now, let me focus on the status of China's AI development. So this is a report that we did with some partners on how, you know, China's AI, what's the status of China's AI development. So first of all, in terms of basic research, China has been leading in AI research papers. So you can see the blue line, that's the papers that China published in over the last, from 1997 to 2017. So it's about 20 years record. And also I think that, in terms of also highly cited, you know, papers and so on, China also lead. So basic research, China, U.S., and some other, and India also. Look at the blue lines. The blue line is India. So this dot is India. So India is also coming out. So this is in basic research. The second high impact papers also China also lead. I think quite interestingly, I think over half of China's top AI papers was published through international collaborations. So in AI research, there's a lot of international collaboration of the Chinese scholars and overseas scholars. At the same time, we also see that actually the industry and academia linkage is quite weak. So if you look at the sort of collaboration between sort of industry and academia, the joint publications, China is only 2.5% is joint collaboration between industry and academia. If you look at sort of, you know, other countries, like, you know, for example, in Canada it's 4.7, and you know, U.S. is close to 7%, and you know, Germany is also over 7%. So I think that part, I think China is relatively weak. In terms of AI patents, China, U.S., Japan is pretty much, I think, more or less are the three. So leading, you know, AI, you know, patenting countries. And in the case of China, about half of the patents were actually patented by people in the universities. So if you look at the industry patenting, you can see the leading companies, you know, all the sort of, you know, the names here are quite familiar, you know, the leading company in the U.S., Japan. Only one company that actually Chinese company in that is so-called the State Grid. They turned out they use a lot of AI technology to make sure they, wow, okay, let me move on. The patents, okay, that's, all, you know, I think the, talents. Talents, actually, the U.S. has the world's largest AI talent force. China follows the second, and this is so the distribution of the, you know, the AI talent. Companies, I think the U.S. lead the world, I think has more than twice of China, you know, of China's number, but China is the second. But in terms of location, Beijing has become really a top place in terms of AI companies. So San Francisco, London, and so on. So. And venture investment. Here it's interesting. I think they're comparing U.S. and China. China has the largest money, largest amount of money invested, you know, venture capital invested in AI. But in terms of number of investments, the U.S. lead. So in other words, in China, maybe there are some major, you know, big one, you know, investment. But in the U.S., it's much more spread. So that's the difference between the two. Market, as you know, these are, you know, all kinds of, you know, in different markets. And finally, okay, let me make some comments about strengths and weaknesses of the AI development. I think, first of all, in terms of strengths, China has a very clear national aspiration and strategy in AI development. And also has a very strong basic research and talent pool. And also, I think now in terms of the venture capital, I think clearly, I mean, so the international, domestic venture capitals, local government, and so on. And also, China has identified very sort of key application areas. One is sort of manufacturing. China's manufacturing is trying to make transition to from sort of very labor-intensive to what's so-called the intelligence in manufacturing. And also, I think in the urban development, you know, China's in this stage of rapid urbanization, so many tremendous problems. So China hopes that to use AI to help to resolve some of these problems, like traffic jam and so on, and also voice and image recognition and so on. And also, I think to the credit of to our community of S&T policy research, I think there's a key awareness of the social and ethical implications of AI development. So I think almost in every policy document, this has been highlighted as a major issue that needs to be concerned about. What's the weakness? I think, first of all, I think that in terms of R&D, industrial R&D capabilities, we know that in China, so-called the Alibaba and all these major companies, but it turned out in terms of their publication, in terms of their patents, very low. Not really on par with their international peers. So I think that's sort of the weak industrial R&D capabilities is one problem. The other is the weak linkage between academia and industry that I mentioned. And also I think there's a wide regional disparity in AI development. I didn't really show you the picture and to see, you know, the distribution. It's very Beijing area, Shanghai, and then southern China. But in terms of interior land, I think there's you see the vacuum. And also, I think that in terms of China's national strategy, there's too much sort of technology push. I think the market, not enough attention to the market. And also, I think there are implementation challenges also. Once the central government has a policy, local government, you know, comes up with sort of many different policies, so sometimes there's a crowd. And also, how to avoid the hype. I think that's, you know, what we all have to be concerned about. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Shui, and thank you for giving us not only a picture of the development of AI in China, but also, across quite a few other countries. Our next speaker is well known to all of us, Morten, so telling us about the landscape in Europe. The floor is yours.
Thank you. I'm going to skip some slides pretty quickly here because it's been covered, so if this will work, that would be great. Doesn't. No, it's actually this. Okay. Yeah, there. Den virker til seg. La oss ta den av og på. Se hva som skjer. Okay. Ja, det var jo ikke gøy. Det var snart fun. Right, what am I going to do now?
Press the button.
Det blir innmari vanskelig.
Men den, ja. Prøv nå. Ok?
Yeah, you're a magician. Thank you. Absolutely. All these things you know. So we're going to move to this. Just start this. Because what I'm going to talk about is not so much the AI policies in the various countries of Europe. I'm going to talk a little bit about the response of Europe as a continent. And I was at the International Joint Conference in AI in Stockholm this summer. It's the largest AI conference in the world, as far as I know. 4,000 people present. And there were 700 papers that was accepted. So let's look at that. 19% were from the United States of the accepted papers. 19% were from Europe. And remember, this is held in Europe. And Asia-Pacific, 60%. And I'm showing you this because the response in Europe can be understood in this backdrop. Okay, I can't see it here, so I have to move this like so I can see this. So we have, today, we have these headlines all the time. China and the US are battling to become the world's first AI superpower. We see pictures like this. And what is missing? What is missing in this picture? It's the rest of the world. And for Europe, it's Europe that is missing. So, and why is that a problem? Well, it's a problem if you think about that many people... The argument is that AI is not a technology. It's like, it's not, you can say, oh, good for United States, good for China, they're good at this, we can do something else. No. AI, it's a collection of technologies, it's a goal, yes. It's a field of study, yes. It's a science, maybe. It's a resource. It's like electricity. It seeps in everywhere. It will define dominance, not only in markets, but in everything else you can imagine in society, including security, military dominance, etc., etc. This is just not another technology. That's the point. Very important point to make. Artificial intelligence is the future not only for Europe, but for all of humankind. It comes with colossal opportunities, but also threats that are difficult to predict. Whoever becomes the leader of this sphere will become the ruler of the world. And that was Vladimir Putin who said that. And he referred to Russia, of course, not Europe. So the best way to predict the future, it said, is to create it. Yes? Or the best way to control your future is to create it. But Europe feels, and a lot of the response in Europe is that they feel that they are leaving the creation of Europe's future to American companies and Chinese technologies. We don't know, but this is what drives the response now in Europe. Lot of countries in Europe are making really great strides. And remember, Europe has an enormous, strong AI, scientific AI base. Strong universities, and historically very strong in AI. But while United States last year had about $18.5 billion in private investments in AI companies, the number in Europe was about $2.5 to $3.5 billion. So, but Europe has some opportunities. It can create systems that leverage strengths across several areas of AI. It can integrate roles and interests of individuals and societies. Given the culture and the political fabric of Europe, it is strengths here that can be leveraged. Puts the human in the center, leverage users and democratize the technology. These are opportunities for Europe. So, Holger yesterday mentioned CLAIR, Confederation of Laboratories for Artificial Intelligence Research in Europe. It's a movement. It's the AI researchers in Europe that have come together and signed a letter, a model of how they believe Europe should respond. And crucially, it says excellence across all of AI, not only machine learning, but the whole spectrum of AI. All of Europe, we have to lift and make use of the fabulous talent that is spread across Europe and not just invest in a few areas. And with a human-centered focus, that will create the strength. CLEAR's goals is excellence in AI, all of Europe, human-centered focus, and to help in this transition. AI made in Europe for the world, of course. But what does Europe need? One fabulously successful example is CERN. Europe needs a CERN for AI. Not exactly with a big particle accelerator, but with a central hub. We really need one place that has a Google-scale infrastructure and where researchers from all over Europe can meet and spend 6 months, 3 months, 3 years working together on large-scale, huge projects and on their own projects in collaborations with others. We really need that. We also need to build up the network of research labs that are regionally and nationally lifted to a level of excellence that we don't have on national scales today, connected with the central hub. This is what Europe needs. CLEAR's hub, focal point of AI research in Europe, Google-scale infrastructure, world-class specialized lab for key applications, cutting-edge usability lab support staff. This is what we in CLEAR believe Europe needs. And Holger was the person who took the initiative to CLEAR. He's in the room. You can go and touch him afterwards. Now, look at this time. Not everybody at the same time. So if we are looking here at the timeline here, you know, up to 2016, 2017, American firms have established market dominance. Then China established a national AI plan. And really, that plan is so ambitious and interesting. And the development in China is so fantastic. And be clear here, it's fabulous for science. Fabulous for science. However, we live in a knowledge society, in a knowledge economy, a global knowledge economy. So knowledge is power. And in particular, if you don't have any knowledge of AI, you give power away. So for Europe, it's also a question of being relevant in the future and take control of their own future. So this also drove the response. The Commission moved into action. 24 European nations signed an agreement of creating strong, an increasing investment in AI on national level and collaboration. That was in April. 2 weeks later in April, the Commission put out a communication that described their ambitions, and I'm going to get back to that in a moment. A high-level expert group, this a little bit bureaucratic and European, of course. High-level expert group started working, people from all over Europe, they meet and talk. CLEAR was a bottom-up research scientist-driven initiative that started because we were seeing that, ooh, where is this going? Let's get the scientists to start talking. This was a main thing with CLEAR. And right these days, we have seen a draft of an action plan, and I will comment on that. Now, 2019... there will be a new parliament in Europe. The Commission is really in a hurry because you really want a budget in place before a new parliament. That's not going to happen, it looks like. Because the new parliament, what do we know about that? Well, we can guess it's going to move to the right. It's going to be more Eurosceptic, and it's going to be more skeptical for this kind of initiatives that we're here talking about. So it's a race here against this clock, too. Now, the main point in the plan that is being developed is in this two-year period up to the end of Horizon 2020, Commission will mobilize 1.5 billion euros a year, or 4 billion, including national funding, in that and feed it into the system. And from 2021, start of Horizon Europe, the next framework program, increase under Horizon Europe aggregate public sector investments to 7 billion per year, and in total, including private investment, reach at least 20 billion euros a year in investments. This is the goal. Now, The Economist had an article in September. To become a powerhouse in AI, Europe will have to overcome its divisions, digital and otherwise. That seems unlikely in the current climate. But where there is political will, there may be a way. Our comments to the action plan? We need a central facility. We need a hub. In order for Europe to really raise up and not just spread money around flat. The action plan should emphasize the need for support of excellence, all of AI, provide substantially more funding for basic research, and spread this idea in the action plan of spreading funding over multiple siloed networks is a really bad idea. We need one strong AI network of researchers and initiatives. Okay, I'm just going to mention here that these, when it comes to CLEAR, it's supported by now like almost 1,400 AI experts around Europe. And you can see this. It's pretty good. And all these are the national AI associations and organizations that is supporting CLEAR. It's a very strong. We have now 2,300 people have signed up for this, and you are going to do that too. All of you. Here it is. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Morten, for this very attractive proposal. And also for keeping very strictly in time, but as being the organizer of this event, you had a strong incentive, of course. Our next speaker is Tse-Yun Leong, who is Director of AI Technology, AI Singapore. The floor
thank
is
you.
Yours.
Thanks. Good morning, and thank you very much for this opportunity to be here to share with you some of the AI activities in Singapore. Well, just like the rest of the world, I say AI has been identified as a new engine for socio-economic growth in Singapore. And in last year, I think Accenture Research and also Frontier Economics have projected that by 2035 or so, AI applications could potentially double the productivity and also improve the efficiency of economic output by 41% for Singapore, bringing a gross value add to about $215 billion. And the major sectors that could be impacted would involve the business services, financial and insurance services, manufacturing, healthcare, social services, and education. Now, Singapore is a very small country. We only have about 200 AI researchers as compared to over thousands and thousands of basic AI researchers. And all of them are actually in different universities and research institutes. And so how do we actually bring together the talent and the limited resources do we have to bring about the social and economic impact in Singapore? So in 2017, the National Research Foundation established and support a national R&D and innovation program called AI Singapore. The mission of AI Singapore is to create a vibrant ecosystem to bring together the talent, the technology, and also to create a test bed and framework to facilitate translation from research in AI to practical industry applications. So, National Research Foundation put in about 150 million Singapore dollars, it's about US $110 million over 5 years, and supported by the major government agencies, including the Economic Development Board, the Infocom Media Development Authority, and also the Smart Nation office in the Prime Minister's office that's actually pushing towards the Smart Nation objective that Singapore is moving forward. And also the partner universities, include the six public universities and also the 20 research institutions under the Agency for Science, Technology and Research in Singapore. And AI Singapore activity is divided into three pillars on AI research, supporting basic research, AI innovation, supporting industry-related activities to bring in the expertise and also to broaden the adoption of AI technologies in the industry, and also AI, the technology pillar that's focusing on translation research. Let me get into the different programs. The AI research is like all the fundamental research programs in academia. We're looking to fund research projects and also to train postdoctoral fellows and also PhD students and master's students. Looking into areas where the researchers will just continue with the investigations and exploration of new ideas that would advance the envelopes of AI methodologies and algorithms, okay? Not just in terms of technologies, but also looking at the social and economic impact of AI in all areas, including the ethical issues, safety and security issues. Well, while this program is focusing on AI, and these are some of the areas that we have identified that we'll be funding in the next 5 years, there is actually another program that's funding robotics research in Singapore as well. So actually we work very closely with that program as well to come up with the national agenda. Of course, these are the scientific and technical areas, and things are evolving very, very quickly. So some of the topics, the focus funding directions could change as well. And of course, one of the major challenges that we have is in talent recruitment and in talent retention. And also, although in recent years, the universities have expanded the enrollment for computing students in undergraduate and also graduate levels, but we still have this challenge of getting enough people to join the program. So we are also looking into international collaboration and also inviting international researchers, the young researchers of graduated to come in and join our faculty and also the researchers. And just put a little advertisement, we are hiring and hope that we will be able to get some AI talent to come and join us. Okay. All right. For the AI innovation pillar, it is actually to looking at how do we actually help the companies, from the multinational companies to the small and medium industries and the local startup companies in Singapore to actually harness the power of AI to improve the business processes and increase the value creation. So with that, we have a program called 100 Experiments. This is a funding program that fund projects of 9 months to about 18 months duration, where the company will identify a specific problem in its business models and processes where AI technologies can help to solve. Okay, then we will bring together a AI researcher, either faculty members or a research a fellow, to work with the company directly on this project and also to support some engineering work. So that at the end of the project, there will be a proof of a concept, a minimal viable product that's ready for the company to adopt and bring it into actual deployment in the company. We fund up to about $250,000. Sing dollars per project, and the industry, the company will have to do a one-to-one matching either in kind or in cash. And also, we are looking at how to address the talent shortage problem, and we also have this AI apprenticeship program where we bring in, actually the aim is to to produce 200 professionals who do not have AI background, but who are engineers or scientists or managers or executives who have the relevant background, will be able to go through 9 months training with courses and also hands-on project involvement, especially working on our 100 E projects. And by the end of the 9 months, they will go back to the industry and they will be able to perform and also carry out some AI-related, perhaps application jobs and operating jobs. Okay, so there's AI apprenticeship program. We actually also have just launched two other programs for the executives, for the managers. We call the AI in Industry, a 3 month program, aiming to train about 2,000 professionals also to take up, so that they'll be able to better make use of AI technologies in application and in the production. And also, we also have outreach programs for the general public and for the schools, and targeting to actually reach a million people on short 3 hours introductions to actually to educate the public. Now, I would like to come back and focus on the middle pillar, the AI technology, where I'm actually mostly responsible for. And the AI technology pillar, one of the key programs is to design and implement AI grand challenges. What are AI grand challenges? We deem AI grand challenges to be important issues or complex issues that's faced by Singapore and the world that can be effectively addressed by AI technologies and innovations. We've identified 3 areas in which AI technology can make a difference and also be able to focus in Singapore because of the context in healthcare, urban solutions, and finance, and in future there could be more areas. And we identify how do we define the grand challenge statement and problem to address? With the objectives that it has to be inspiring, it has to be an important problem that's going to impact a lot of people with significant outcomes and consequences, and it has to be measurable in that it should have clear objectives and translational pathway. Okay, so over the course of the last year, we have focus on healthcare, and we have actually launched AI in healthcare grand challenge. And the domain of the AI in health grand challenge is in addressing the issues caused by the 3 highs. We call the high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and high blood sugar, that's diabetes. Now, these are the 3 top chronic conditions and diseases in Singapore with devastating consequences if we leave it untouched, because it will lead to very serious complications like heart diseases, strokes, renal failure, the kidney failure, and eye complications, and also the food complications, with the potential economic impact would cost about $4 billion Singapore dollars per year. Okay, and it has a very big population. We have a very big population who are affected by this disease. So we come up with a AI and Health Grand Challenge, which is a competitive research initiative. Okay, with this characteristics, it's 5 years, 2 stage, with the total budget of about 35 million Sing dollars. Okay, and we're actually looking into how to get consortia of researchers, domain experts to come together to work on this, address these problems, and we are also building multidisciplinary teams internationally. We're inviting international experts and also working with some of the countries like France, UK, and Canada in China, looking at how we can actually fund and also to facilitate the collaborators to come together. This is just an example. This is the actual statement itself. The program is with the long-term aspiration goal to halve the prevalence. And then the challenge itself is a specific statement that has to slow or stop the disease progression by 20% over 5 years. And some of the AI technologies that we see that involve will be able to help the primary care team to look at risk prediction, better do diagnosis and treatment, care plans, compliance behavior, communications, and optimizing care resources. Okay. So the grand challenge journey, it is actually the statement itself and also the content is defined by the researchers, the domain users, and also the domain experts together, in alignment with the national priorities and also the ministry plans. The grant call was launched in June. We're actually in the final stage of evaluation. We're expecting to announce the project award at the end of the year. So These are some of the grant challenge program characteristics. This is actually a new and experimental way, a novel way to actually try to expedite the invention to application process by actually facilitating the researchers to work together with the domain experts and also to provide engineering support and training a group of engineers who will be able to effectively help to translate research results into a viable prototype for easy translation down the line. We are also looking at how do we actually facilitate the setup and also access to resources by working with the government agencies directly and for access to some of the data and the regulatory framework. So in summary, we will have also come up with a new IP model because to try to mitigate the long process of IP negotiations among all the parties by coming up with a model where all the research artifacts and the results will be actually exclusively licensed to a company limited by guarantee, and which will actually manage all the IP and also try to put some of them, the tools and the data, into an AI commons in a source available model, but with ownership preserved. That means AI Singapore does not own any of the IP, but the IP belongs to the creators and the performers. Okay, we also just want to build an international AI knowledge hub for where our results and the output will be shareable, and it's used for free by the researchers and the government and other subscription model. So this is a very quick summary of what we have done. AI Singapore is very young. We actually just completed our 1 year anniversary in August. Okay, the three pillars, and I just want to highlight that AI Singapore is not the only AI-related programs and initiatives in Singapore. Singapore has set up an advisory council on ethical use of AI and data. It includes a group of international and local experts with representatives from technology side, policy and legal framework, and also the consumer and social advocates. And also set up a center for AI and data governance, okay, and looking at the different issues on AI in society, trade, and also commercialization. And also there's very active support for corporate AI research labs to invite the companies, the industry, to set up research labs in the universities. I think following a lot of the models in other countries to let the researchers to work together in industry-related problems. And also there are different sectoral initiatives for AI-driven projects in the different ministries, for example, transportation, in the Monetary Authority of Singapore for Finance, and so on and so forth. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Leong. It's impressive, and we all notice a job vacancy that you put there. If we are to do again this event, we could attach a job fair or something like that. I'm sure there would be even more people in this room. So our next and last speaker is Philip Young. Philip is Head of Strategic Policy Delivery at Digital Catapult UK. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for inviting. I won't go into Oscar-level thank yous for being here, but it's been a really interesting couple of days so far. So I'm Head of Strategic Policy Delivery, which is somewhat a made-up title, essentially I work for Digital Catapult, which is a non-profit, government-backed innovation centre in the UK. In light of the UK's background, I suppose, we typically haven't invested as much as other G7 countries into R&D. We're somewhere around 1.7%, with Germany and the US somewhere around 2.4%, with aspirations of being higher. The Catapult Network was set up very much with the goal of increasing R&D by industry. And we are part government funded, part industry funded through commercial work, and part funded through grants and other activities. And we are responsible for accelerating the early adoption of advanced digital technologies across the UK. So Digital Catapult is one of many catapults. Digital Catapult itself has a number of centres, but we have catapults in high-value manufacturing, we have catapults in medicines discovery, transport systems, etc. And we all strive to grow the UK economy in those sectors by deploying and driving innovation into those sectors. Digital is somewhat cross-cutting, so it means kind of everything to everyone, which is slightly challenging. But we break it down into four key emerging technologies that we work with. So artificial intelligence is obviously the main one. We also explore future networks, immersive technologies, so VR, AR, we're starting to explore distributed ledger technologies, so I was very interested in the work in discussions yesterday. And the main challenges that we have, that we're looking to address is digital transformation challenges for industry. So there's obviously lots of legacy systems, there's lots of challenges in deploying these technologies. There is also a lack of access to state-of-the-art facilities, so there's nowhere for companies to test new products, services, experiences, business models. So we almost act as a make-weight to large tech giants by providing state-of-the-art facilities that startups wouldn't necessarily be able to afford to invest in themselves. We act as an independent convener and a neutral convener across the economy by bringing together lots of different parts of the economy, providing independent advice to them so that we don't have an interest other than growing the UK economy. So our goal is very much about helping them understand how to work together and bridging those cultural divides which come from a knowledge gap and a lack of understanding around the return on investment for some of these technologies as well. We build and operate physical and digital facilities. We deliver specialized innovation programs. We convene and deliver collaborative research and development. And we leverage public funding to bring about increased private investment. So this is where we seek to sort of increase this R&D spend. So as I said, we kind of sit in and amongst all of this sort of ecosystem from startups and scale-ups, the rest of the Catapult network through to accelerators, investors, corporates and industry. We act as an independent trusted advisor to government and we work very closely with the research and academia space. At risk of sounding like a bit of a plug for Digital Catapult, the reason that I'm mentioning that is that the Catapult Network is a big government investment. It is very much about driving the growth of these technologies into the UK. And we have just had our next five-year funding announced just a couple of weeks ago. And there is a continued push, both internationally and on national level, for catapults to be of very strategic importance to degrowing these technologies. So I appreciate that there may be a few figures floating around about this stuff, which may not all match up, but certainly from our research, we are fourth globally by number of publications in AI and machine learning. We are globally third by number of citations behind China and the US. We're second globally after the US for impact of the research, according to the H Index. And we have four of the top 20 global universities in computer science in the UK as well. The EPSRC, which is the Research Council for Engineering and Physical Sciences in the UK, has also funded 46 institutions in AI and machine learning across the UK. There are also lots of varying numbers of companies that are kind of cited across the world about who has the strength in the most number of AI companies and such. We have over 1,000 AI companies in the UK. That has just been come out in a report that was an extensive report that was commissioned by the House of Lords by Big Innovation Centre that came out literally a couple of weeks ago. You can find it online. And this is all of the different people within that ecosystem. It's quite a comprehensive map. I think it's over a sort of 1,000-page document. It's very, very good. We, as you can see, Digital Catapult, right in the middle, are one of the AI hubs. So we bring lots of AI companies into this world, and we really help support them through all of the activities that we run. So, what's important for Digital Catapult is really understanding and really the role that I play within the Catapult as well. We have a team who do ecosystem mapping. We get out and meet startups and scale-ups, and we understand what their barriers are to growth. For AI startups, the key challenges that we've found are AI readiness. So typically, AI is not sold out of the box. There's a lot to be done around it before you can deploy it effectively. And really navigating this space is quite challenging for companies. And there needs to be either specific domain expertise that's put into the AI companies or vice versa. And it's quite disparate and it's quite difficult to make sure that those two worlds work together. There is a challenge, of course, around data, but not just big data. It's about good quality data, labeled data, clean data, as we like to call it sometimes. And often the data owners don't really have the expertise in AI or data science. And again, it's about how do we open up that data and how do we overcome that challenge, that which is often quite cultural, but sometimes technical as well. Computation power, actually... we did a report at the beginning of this year called Machines for Machine Intelligence. You can also find that online. Identified that 60% of startups that we surveyed said they were compute constrained. It can cost anywhere upwards of £10,000 to train an algorithm in AI. And often what you find is startups burn through a lot of their free credits in trying to find out what their product or proof of concept is going to be. And then when you get to the point of actually deploying a lot of the stuff and you need those cloud credits, that's where the sales pipeline for Google Cloud, et cetera, has come in, and they're able to start charging. The challenge is that they're never really going to equate or equal some of these really large tech giants in their ability to train those algorithms and create these products and services for the future. And it's the lifeblood of AI's growth is through that. So it's very important part of it. And then finally, technical debt, as I've mentioned before, is sort of deployment of AI. There's a lot of complex tools that need to be put in around AI, and AI companies themselves don't always have all of that expertise. An AI team within Google or Amazon, etc., probably do, so they can deploy a UX expert, a front-end developer. They can have different skills that can be deployed. But often you find in AI companies, it's very hard to keep up with the changing tool landscape. This whole thing around DevOps and deployment of AI technologies is a real challenge. So we're exploring at the moment some how can we help support in this AI plumbing landscape. So how do you actually deploy artificial intelligence? And as I mentioned before, the return on investment challenge for understanding what these technologies do for industry. We run a program called Machine Intelligence Garage, which we launched in January 2018. There are 25 startups, four cohort intakes that we've had. We've had computation power, hardware advice and support, and innovation acceleration activities that are run within that program. And it's helped secure a number of raises and acquisitions, which are sometimes a good or a bad thing, depending on how you look at it. But Bloomsbury AI were actually bought by Facebook this year as well. So I'm going to kind of fly through a little bit of the UK's AI strategy, simply for the fact that there's a lot of it. the industrial strategy was launched in 2017. It has five foundations, and AI and data economy is one of the grand challenges, along with clean growth, future mobility, and aging society. But AI in itself weaves through all of those grand challenges, so it's quite an interesting component to it. There's also a number of sector deals that have been pushed out, so partnerships between government and industry on sector-specific issues. And there's a £1.7 billion CR&D funding across grand challenges and sector deals as well. Number of sector deals, there's life sciences, construction, the AI sector deal itself, automotive, creative industries, Made Smarter, which is the Industry 4.0 initiative for the UK, and nuclear. they are really about the industry push for adoption of these technologies, and AI is at the core of all of them. Made Smarter, for example, has just been announced a couple of weeks ago. It's received £121 million of funding, with match funding from industry as well, with one of its core tenets around artificial intelligence. The UK government has committed almost £1 billion of support for AI. That probably has gone over £1 billion now because of a few recent announcements. A lot of the interesting sort of components of this is that there are lots of different areas that they're trying to focus on in terms of industry or research, but also it's a lot about supporting startups and deployments into industry. So that's one of the key things. The Alan Turing Institute is the national Institute for AI, and it has just announced £50 million for its global Turing Fellowships to drive increased number of researchers. We also have steps to create data sharing frameworks called data trusts to identify and overcome barriers to sharing data. So that's legal agreements and templates that people can use and start working with. And also there's a big investment into 5G and how that can drive the ubiquity of AI in the future through cloud technologies for consumers. And I think this is probably the main thing to raise. So the business environment is rapidly evolving. The UK government has recently set up the AI Council, which is a representative body of AI industry in the UK, made up of research and startups. There's the Office for Artificial Intelligence, which is a joint business and industrial strategy department and DCMS department initiative. And there is a Centre for Data Ethics and Innovation, which the UK is starting to look at ways that we can really define what our USP is on the global stage. I think we won't be able to duke it out with China and the US in terms of levels of investment, but what we would like to do is rely on the quality and the ethical nature of the deployments of AI that we're looking to do. And very finally, so I have a few key challenges that we've identified in the policy landscape. There's a disparate understanding of AI by policymakers, and they tend to focus on ethics and skills because they're simple things for them to really understand in terms of the challenges that are faced in deploying AI. And so often you see a big focus on that sort of push. And it's not just the UK, that's everywhere. And that's why there are so many institutions that spring up around all of these sort of things. But I really think the key is adoption. And there's a big fear around AI adoption. But actually, it's a real challenge to even get it deployed. That's a big issue. There is an increasing focus on adoption, but there's still a lack of understanding. As I mentioned before, acquisitions by large tech giants, UK companies get bought quite a lot by big US companies, Magic Pony, Twitter, Bloomsbury, Facebook, Google DeepMind, obviously everybody knows, and SwiftKey was bought by Microsoft. And the investment landscape in the UK is still quite risk averse, and is not as robust as in the US. We don't move quick enough as well is my concern, but I think that's a challenge with all governments, so that's it. And that's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye, take care.
May I ask speakers to come? Well, we can bring them.
I say I'm a bit...
And Philippe's last slide was a very good transition to my question. In fact, the plans that you presented made me thinking of traditional industrial policies in the 50s, 60s, where government would target a particular area or objective, could be energy, telecoms, and the like. It would invest quite a significant amount of money in the technology, on the demand side as well, and so on. So there are similarities, but there is also one important difference. In these plans in the 60s, governments usually had a main interlocutor or a few main interlocutors with large national companies. Mm-hmm. That's something that four of you are missing. I won't say which ones. And so you are compensating that by investing in these ecosystems of startups and so on, with the view that the giants of tomorrow are being born today, and that first. And second, probably the vision that the gains from AI will be quite diffuse. They will go across industries. So established companies which are not in AI might be users of AI and will modernize their, and so on, which is certainly true. That said, if we keep to the core AI, I would refer to a recent book by Kai-Fu Lee, who is a former Google executive, I think, and then moved to Baidu, and is now still in Beijing, but as a venture capitalist, and he's a sort of guru of AI, and he knows a bit of the matter. And he has a sort of diagnosis that there will be two survivors globally, especially one, that are the two largest countries on the planet. The mechanism behind that being the usual sort of winner-take-all operations with economies of scale due to data, with network economies and the like. So from a national policymaker perspective, what can you do about it when you have your startups like the successful one, DeepMind? You reminded us that, Philippe, in your last slide. As soon as they are successful, they sort of join the galaxy of these global giants. So what? How do national governments see this this issue of national investment, global gains? So who wants to start?
I mean, there are big challenges with acquisitions from my point of view. I think Canada has a similar
we
challenge.
Do, yeah.
It's how do you retain talent in your country? You really have to create an ecosystem that is supportive, that is at the same time global, so that you have the opportunities to facilitate trade and export for those scale-ups. So that they are able to access new markets, and we've recently been doing some work with Canada. We have an AI innovation challenge that actually had its pitch off yesterday evening, which will allow, it's solving a problem from Bombardier, which is a Canadian aerospace company, and we've had a number of AI companies from the UK and a number of AI companies from Canada all compete for what will be the final prize, and I think things like that will really help open up new doors for collaboration, new trade, and mean that it makes sense to stay in that country. Now, that in itself is good, and I think the flip side of that is that there's still not a big enough investment community in the UK or lots of other countries outside of China and the US. The money really resides in those two countries, and there's a big risk that they still come along and buy these companies. So what policies can help? You know, some radical ones to say, you know, do we allow other countries to buy our AI talent? And if so, what are the parameters of that? And do we need to put parameters on it? But
Elisa, you want to?
The Canadian experience is very much the same as the UK. The biggest challenge that we have now, we have 650 startups. Philip and I were comparing notes yesterday. So we have 650 AI startups across Canada, and it's great to have that many startups, but how many scale-ups do we have? How many medium-sized AI-related companies do we have? Not very many at all. And either they're being bought or, you know, they don't have the access to the computational technology that they need to scale, or they don't, primarily, the big question is, you know, they don't have the investment. They don't have the venture capital. And so, you know, we're starting in Canada to start to think about what policies do we need to adopt to help these startup companies. And a big key, I think, for us will be access to global markets. We still are very isolated in Canada, not great access to Europe. Our companies don't have great access to Europe or to Asia, for that matter. And so I think that will be a key step for us going forward to help those companies to grow.
Singapore, Europe. Professor, I will give you the floor.
I think from Singapore's perspective, all we can do is to collaborate. That's in our initial strategy, and also going forward, how we implement all the different schemes. Because we're very small, we will not be able to survive just looking at the local market. So from all the way from research to translation to the startups and also the small and medium companies, we have actually some of the policies in place is that we work very closely with the international partners. For a startup, the university, the government has put in the incubator funds, and then we'll bring in a venture capitalist in Singapore and also from overseas. And in terms of the companies, to bringing in overseas companies, large multinational companies to set up research labs in Singapore. And that is a way for our local talent and the local market to be opened up to international.
Europe and then China.
It's a really a problem. I mean, we're not only losing startup companies and early stage scale-up companies, we're losing talents. En masse, it's a huge problem. We're seeing just a brain drain, an accelerating brain drain in universities and in industry. There are, in the plans for the European Union, there are various components that include setting up various types of investment, joint venture investment funds with industry between national governments, the European Commission and industry. But which are the large companies in Europe that have this? The large companies in Europe are, they come from a different era. So we're, you know, Germany is great at robotics because they need robotics in the manufacturing industry. Who are the ones that are trying to turn upside down the markets like Google tried to do? So, I don't, you know, we can go back to the 50s and think about these types of interventions from governments in order to solve what you can call a type of national or regional market failure, or you can just say our future is to create great small companies that will be bought up by others. I don't know. I don't have an answer.
So, Professor Shui, do you have an answer?
I don't. I actually have a question. Well, let me first comment on China's situation. Then let me, if possible, I'd like to have a question to our colleague here. I think, first of all, in China's case, I think the China actually has a few major giant companies, like Alibaba, Baidu, and Tencent, and so on. And increasingly, I think they are really, you know, buying a lot of small startups. Mm-hmm. So becoming sort of, in a way, I think some people are concerned about the ecosystem. You know, I mean, in a way, I think many of small companies, you have to line up. Either you're on the side of the Alibaba or Tencent. So I think there's some sort of, you know, big this conglomerate sort of competition on that. And the second challenge, I think, in China is that of course, we certainly would like to see a sort of global sort of AI ecosystem, but now increasingly, I think Chinese companies are facing sort of barriers in terms of entering a global market, particularly in the U.S. case. And so I think that's sort of, you know, going to be the challenge that China is facing next stage. The question I'm going to have for our colleagues here, I think I'm sort of quite fascinated by the idea that central hub, as you mentioned, that there's a need for a central hub. I'm just wondering to what degree that why AI you need a central hub. Because I think, you know, in some previous other technologies one can think of, that somehow you need, you know, a sort of central hub, certain scale. But for AI, why? So I think that's sort of, you know, a question that I have in mind that when you were making the presentation. So. Martin. If I may.
Yes, you may. but before I answer that, I will go back to my previous comment. I was on purpose polemic. If you look at the strengths of Europe, Europe can create an enormous advances in using AI in business to business, in using AI in manufacturing, in using AI in healthcare, using AI in various dimensions of government, in using AI, you know, and you can create a long list where Europe is really strong and can apply AI. And it's to a less degree obvious directly into the consumer market, but it's an enormous market. So when that, so no, I gave you both. And when it comes to the hub, well, I believe that, and Claire believes, and many 1,400 AI scientists in Europe believes that, in order for Europe to scale up, Europe is so fragmented. Europe's many of the Europe's labs and research facilities are relatively small. By creating a place where, like, I use the image of CERN for AI, where you actually can create a more rapid knowledge transformation between partners in Europe. It will accelerate the research done in the various research centers and centers for excellence across Europe. So I believe that is very important. So it's not, this hub is not going to be like a mega thing that is going to, it's going to be an instrument to drive innovation and science across all of Europe. And I do believe that is a way of accelerating it.
Well, given the politics in Europe,
well, Mr. Hagner addressed that issue, where it's going to be located.
Well,
sorry.
$1 trillion question.
Probably not in London.
Okay.
One question there. Please, 30 seconds per question.
Following on for the AI of CERN AI, essentially, is there an example of a thing like that that has existed around something that wasn't a physical facility that needed to exist somewhere? Because we talk a lot, actually, at Catapult and in the UK, about how can we connect together hubs of activity that are don't necessarily need that physical space, but make them into something bigger than their, you know, constituent parts. Is there an example of where that has worked that hasn't been around a facility?
Is there an example of where you put this kind of very or a looser connection? You know, let's do some science via Skype for a while and see how that works. I'm being a little bit polemic here, but I really believe that innovation happens when people meet.
Yep.
Okay. Next question, 30 seconds.
That's a good answer. That's a good answer.
No, I have a follow-up on this one, which is to do with scale, country scale and the impacts of AI. Is there a sense where actually there might be a physical infrastructure that can be a constraint at some point? Is there something like a winning model that once one company or one model follows away, that's it and everybody has to adhere to it? And then does it mean like for a developing country, for other countries, like smaller countries, it's just like they take off the shelf AI from that leading thing? Because there's many different ways how you can think about country scale and in that context. See.
Yeah, quickly, then the think of AI hub is actually in order. So countries in Europe that doesn't have 1,000 businesses starting up, but really good scientists can then participate in the and then whatever happens on the innovation side or generating of activities that leads to value creation, it has to be built around it. That has to be done on a national scale. Various countries in Europe need to make use of the infrastructure and the facilities that will be set up in order to generate that value creation.
So we have three questions left. First, 30 seconds each.
So I really don't like this discussion about do we need a Facebook or a Google in, in Europe. That really leads the discussion in a way that is not helpful, because we lost that war. We are not going to have that. But what we have, and I would like to strengthen that, is in B2B business. We build wonderful machines. We're really good in manufacturing. We have a lot of hidden champions. And we have to equip these companies with the abilities. That's what I like about your talk about Singapore. We have to get the training that they basically burden their services, that they have the machines and they have to put AI into practice to provide new services, new new technologies together with that they already have. And that's what we should discuss about. And we should be only be scared if whether another company basically takes over that. And China is making great progress. You have this Made in China 2025 in manufacturing. And there I see a real danger. It's not Facebook or Google, but it's when China is going to catch up in manufacturing industry and building these machines and then putting that together with AI strengths they have, then we're going to have a real problem. And it's not Facebook and it's not Google. Just want to strengthen.
So I'm not going to ask a question, but rather make a comment. I think the most important thing right now is for the public sector to wake up and not leave AI to industry. And that's not because industry is evil. But this is for exactly the same reason that when the human genome, it was clear that it could be sequenced, the public woke up and said, we will not leave this to industry. We will do this together with industry. In this case, it was two separate efforts. I think in AI, it must be the same. We must invest into infrastructure at Google scale, facilities of that nature in order to compete with industry in the public sector. This is the only way to keep any AI excellence in the public sector. And I think we can all imagine why that is important. And of course, that means we still will work with industry very productively. Industry will, in fact, benefit from this just as it happened in biomedical sciences.
Your neighbor, and then you will have
just
the floor, last word.
Make a very quick comment.
No. First, no. The question.
Okay.
Okay. I had a half answer to the lady at the back there about do we need one physical infrastructure. EIT Digital has this model of hubs. So there's Berlin, Stockholm, Paris, London, Budapest. And that sort of works. I mean, they've created their own network. Whether it's the network we want, as a question, but for me that seems slightly better than one single place that we can't decide where it should be. Okay, right, good. We can talk about this at coffee. And then the other one, which is more to my own heart, our Canadian colleague mentioned initiatives for young women in this AI initiative. I'm very worried about the middle to more senior women that I do not see in the field, and it tends to be that young girls need female role models to work from.
Absolutely.
So, as far as I can see it now, we're going to have a huge male-dominated AI field 5 or 10 years from now, and I don't know what to do about it. So,
not necessarily, actually. I think one of the best-known AI figures at Stanford University is Fei-Fei Li, who actually created this platform for sharing the data, actually, in that helped to accelerate the deep learning.
So
and also initiatives to include women in
AI
for all.
So last word for a few seconds, you, Philippe?
I was going to say I completely agree with Holger. I think there's a big challenge with industry's understanding around what AI is and does. I work very closely on the Made Smarter stuff, which is the Industry 4.0 work, and there is a disparate misunderstanding around what AI can actually do, and it's not just really industry, and it's a propagated myth that AI is going to completely transform everything almost overnight, and it's a long emerging technologies don't get adopted overnight. I can't see why AI would be any different. There is a long, painful, arduous task of getting it adopted by industry, and I completely agree that the public sector do need to invest into this balancing the playing field activities, providing opportunities for startups in particular, and also researchers to work with startups to be able to collaborate and bring together innovations and new products and services that will be developed for the future. And we can only do that through everyone working together, including the breaking down of the barriers from government. So I completely agree with that.
Okay, thank you all. We will stop now. We are 10 minutes late. What time do we reconvene, Morten? You are the boss, huh? 11:30, so it's a 20-minute break. I propose that we upload our panelists. Thank you.